Chapter 41. Having proposed plausible scenarios as to why three American icons were killed in the prime of their lives, how, and by whom, it is also important to more fully consider the human side of them and what they and the world lost when an entertainment superstar, a charismatic president with unlimited potential, and arguably one of the most revered journalists and media icons who ever lived, died. It is certainly possible to gloss over what they could have accomplished if they had lived longer and instead focus on the tragic circumstances by which they passed away, but a better alternative is to focus on the positive aspects of their lives. None of them was perfect, that's for sure, but each brightened the world they lived in, albeit in separate ways. Like Marilyn Monroe, Dorothy Kilgallen had overcome gender obstacles to climb to the top of her career. Along the way, she always had an ear for the unfortunate woman, journalist or not, caught in the perils of career decisions, especially in New York City, which ate women alive who couldn't handle the big city way of life. An example appeared on page 38 of the January 1948 issue of TV Radio Mirror magazine, an indication of the human side of the famous reporter and media icon that has been little known until now. The article under Kilgallen's byline was called Right Here at Home, and on the accompanying page, a photo appeared of her alongside with her two toddlers, Richard Jr. and Jill, with them seated around a huge metal drum in what was called the Drum Room in the East 68th Street townhouse. The caption read, "Dickie and Jill just invented a brilliant new game and were showing me how it went when the phone rang." The article was promoted as, "Dorothy Kilgallen, shown at home with her children, is heard Thursday, 10:45 a.m. on ABC in Star Time with Dorothy Kilgallen," another media project among many for her at the time. This one was a true story dealing with a woman named Joan Carter, who had lived in a little Ohio town called Elmwood and had never traveled farther than Cincinnati before moving to New York City. Kilgallen wrote that Carter had left behind a man she truly loved named Curtis for the bright lights of the big city where Kilgallen, sympathetic to her having no friends, helped Carter land a good job working for a noted costume designer. Capturing the romantic aspects of the story while showing off her gift as a wordsmith, Kilgallen detailed how, while Carter loved her job and the city, she missed Curtis, who refused to move east with her. Realizing Carter was unhappy, Kilgallen began to mother the early 20s woman after realizing, "All that winter and spring, Joan stayed grimly on. Yes, there was something grim about it all, because she wasn't happy." When Carter almost married the wrong man, the savvy columnist took action, showing tough love for her young friend. In a paragraph delving into her own state of mind at the time, providing insight into the woman Kilgallen was, she wrote, "I'll tell you, Joan, I like being well known. I like it when Dick and I walk into a supper club and are immediately taken to the best table because we're celebrities. But if we moved to London or Paris, do you suppose anyone in either of those cities would think we were important? Of course they wouldn't." Kilgallen went on to explain that, "Wherever you are, you make the best of it," but that her love for Curtis was most important and that as dreary as Elmwood, Ohio sounded, that was where she belonged, with Curtis, her true love. Carter listened, since the moral of Kilgallen's story made sense. Carter moved back to Ohio, married Curtis, and became involved in his political ambitions, happy as never before, all possible because the famous columnist cared about a young woman in need. In the Good Housekeeping article of September 1954, titled "Practically Anybody Can Do It," previously mentioned, the proud mother side of Dorothy Kilgallen came through. She wrote, "My mother and her friends used to say, 'Having a baby is a year out of a woman's life.' And they really believed that. Carrie was no year out of my life. During the months I spent waiting for him, I got in quite a bit of living. I performed as wife and mother, housekeeper and career girl. I wrote a daily Broadway column, did 10 radio programs a week, appeared on What's My Line every Sunday night before an estimated 25 million television viewers, and dashed off a few magazine articles. I helped my children with their homework, mended toys, found lost school caps, dried tears, took temperatures, nursed bruises. I shopped. I danced. A week before Carrie arrived, I had supper at El Morocco with the Duchess of Windsor. During the whole time, I conducted business as usual, and I had fun. Speaking to what the future may have held regarding her new son, Kilgallen added, "And now I have him, and I hold him in the curve of my arm and dream the dreams of all mothers. I dream of what kind of boy he will be and what kind of man. Will I sit in a football stadium and watch him run 60 yards for a touchdown? Or will it be a box in Carnegie Hall, he on the stage playing his Grieg concerto? I dream, and I see his name in type, looking different every time. Red Colmer, star halfback for Notre Dame. Dr. Kerry Arden Colmer, famous Nobel Prize-winning nuclear physicist. Captain Kerry Colmer, pilot of the first rocket ship to the moon." This was the human side of Kilgallen, the mother who, when she died, lost the chance to spend years on end with her beloved son, Kerry. Because Kilgallen died, she could not laugh and play with him, watch him grow up, be there for him when he skinned his knee and cried, or when he fell off his bicycle and would have run into her loving arms for comfort. When she died, he was only 11 years old, not even a teenager yet, and because she died on November 8, 1965, she could not attend a meeting at his school the next day. The last memory of Kerry for her would probably have been the afternoon before she left for her final What's My Line program. Hopefully she had a final hug and kiss to give to her young son, a farewell she did not know was a farewell. This is the woman who died so tragically, the woman murdered by those who stole her motherhood, a motherhood that meant more to her than all the accolades showered on this famous journalist and media icon through the years. No doubt Kilgallen would have given up all of that to live a full life so she could enjoy her children, especially Kerry, whom she loved more than herself. Recall that when JFK died, it was his fussing over Kerry during a White House visit that Kilgallen most cherished. The picture that stays in my mind was the one of this tall young man bending over a small boy, carefully scrutinizing envelopes until he came to the name Kerry Arden Colmer, grade 3B. This was the man who was assassinated in Dallas. Regarding JFK's assassination, if Kilgallen had lived, arguably there would have been action-packed months and years ahead. Just imagine the following. Returning to New York City from New Orleans with her new evidence connecting Marcello, Oswald, and Ruby, Kilgallen completed her JFK and Oswald assassinations investigation. She exposed the evidence in a series of Journal American articles, or perhaps more likely, organized the material into manuscript form so that Bennett Cerf could have rushed her book into publication at Random House in early 1966. Either way, Kilgallen's conclusion that the JFK and Oswald assassinations were simply part of a very successful mob operation, it appears certain, would have shone through. Soon after, the shocking evidence Kilgallen revealed triggered a full-scale grand jury investigation of the twin assassinations, including subpoenaing of relevant witnesses. With Kilgallen as the star witness, the grand jury issued an indictment charging Carlos Marcello and his Dallas underlings with conspiracy to murder JFK and Oswald. Based on the same evidence Kilgallen produced, J. Edgar Hoover was indicted. The charge was obstruction of justice by deliberately preventing any investigation of the twin assassinations. He resigned, pending the outcome of the court proceedings. Through Kilgallen's disclosures, disbarment proceedings were filed against Melvin Belli for having compromised Jack Ruby's constitutional rights to adequate representation. Ruby's new attorney was working on a plea agreement with the Dallas prosecutors that would save his life. Instead of being forgotten through the years, Kilgallen's findings were included in any and all discussions and debates about the JFK assassination. As a result of her relentless search for what really occurred in Dallas in November 1963, Kilgallen's theories became part of the historical record. For her tireless dedication to truth and justice, Dorothy Kilgallen earned the Pulitzer Prize for Journalism. In the audience, husband Richard and children Dickie, Jill, and Carrie loudly applauded their wife and mother, a true beacon of inspiration whose work acumen served as a role model to men and women alike. Yes, this is just a short list of the accomplishments Dorothy Kilgallen may have enjoyed if she had lived even a few years longer. And, perhaps more than anything, if her book had been published, demystifying what many have erroneously called the greatest murder mystery in history, the JFK assassination, the course of history would have changed for the better. To recall who she really was, especially the fun-loving side that many grew to love over the years and now enjoy today with all of the reruns of What's My Line on the Internet, watching the first few minutes of a YouTube video of her as the star panelist of the program provides moments of frivolity never to be forgotten as collected by a fan named Teddy Todorova. Best of all, filling the screen at times is her most precious trait, her laugh during instances where she is teased, where Kilgallen exhibits being a good sport. Among the program highlights are episodes where she commits a gaffe by mixing up parts of questions she asked, such as goat from a cheese, causing the audience and her fellow panel members to laugh, one where the contestant sells maternity clothes during a time when Kilgallen is pregnant, the guest stumped her, and hilarious exchanges with celebrity guests when Kilgallen asks several of them, "Have you ever studied dentistry?" To which the celebrities, among them Sean Connery, Bob Hope, and Gene Kelly, shake their heads while stifling laughter. When asked later to explain the bizarre question, she told the panel that New York Yankee manager Casey Stengel once studied dentistry, and she hoped to catch his identity if he was the mystery guest. Regarding President John F. Kennedy and his future, had he not been the victim of an assassination in 1963, the potential for what might have happened is muddied a bit by the possibility that during the 1964 election, his various affairs, including the one with Marilyn, might have tainted his reputation enough to tilt the election to an opponent. Even if JFK had won, he would have faced continuing pressure to exit Vietnam, an uphill battle regarding the seething civil rights issue, the continuing Cold War battle with Khrushchev and the Russians, and his dreams about the space program pushing the envelope. Nevertheless, the potential was unlimited regarding what the president may have accomplished. All this is speculation, but what is not concerns the human side of JFK, who, through his tragic death, never would enjoy seeing Caroline or John John grow up. He wouldn't be able to help them with their homework, show them how to drive a car, take them on travels around the globe, and watch each enter grade and high school and then college. He would never attend either one's wedding when they married, enjoy grandchildren, and so much more. There seemed little credible information regarding the inside story of time spent by JFK with his children until 2011, when then 53-year-old Caroline Kennedy was interviewed by Parade's Dotson Rader. The information was based on interviews that noted historian Arthur M. Schlesinger recorded with Jackie Kennedy within months of JFK's death that Caroline permitted to be used in a new book entitled Jacqueline Kennedy, Historic Conversations on Life with John F. Kennedy. Insight into the type of household Caroline grew up in was most interesting. She said, "Education was the most important value in our home when I was growing up. People don't always realize that my parents shared a sense of intellectual curiosity and a love of reading and of history. One of my favorite parts in the new book is where my mother talks about my father and how he used to read all the time, even when you wouldn't think a person could read. He'd read when he was getting dressed. He'd read when he was walking. If there was something she was reading and found interesting, he would take it right out of her hand and read the whole book." Caroline added, I don't remember my father reading to me, but I remember him telling me bedtime stories. I got to pick what was in them, and then he'd make them up. They were adventure stories. I had two ponies in them. One was black with a white star, and one was white with a black star, and they were called White Star and Black Star. I could pick who rode the other one. Mostly I picked my cousin Stevie. My father was spectacular at making up stories, and he used to tell me about a purple shark. Yes, he said there was a purple shark that used to follow the Honey Fitz, the small presidential yacht. It liked to eat socks. My father would make people throw their socks overboard, and they'd disappear. He'd say, "See? See? Did you see the purple shark? He ate the socks." And I'd go, "I don't really see him. Uh-oh, I think I see him. Look, the socks are gone, so it must have been the shark that ate the socks." Those stories were fantastic. Caroline's account was extended in 2011 with the release of the Jacqueline Kennedy book for which Caroline wrote the foreword. Further insight into John Kennedy the man included Jackie having written, "And once I asked him, a month after we were married, what he thought his best and worst qualities were. And he thought his best quality was curiosity, which I think he was right. He thought his worst quality was irritability, but I think by that he meant impatience. You know, he didn't like to be bored." Closeness with John was evident through an account Jacqueline recalled regarding when the president would take a bath. She wrote, "I always thought it was so funny that people who used his bathroom, guests, it was the bathroom that men could use after dinner because all along his tub were all these little floating animals, ducks and pink pigs and things." She said, "They were there because he said, 'Give me something to do to amuse John while I'm in my bath.' So John would float all these things around." The First Lady also recalled the day when a famous photo was taken, one cherished by all of those who loved John Kennedy. She first recounted how the children would come over to his office just as he was finishing up for the day, and how John would play on Mrs. Lincoln's typewriter. She added, "One of the last days I remember, well, you know, there's that wonderful picture of them all talking about Berlin and Jack, which was an awful sort of a crisis, and John tumbling out from under his desk." Adding to Jacqueline's account of JFK's love for his children was her having written, "You know, the children were never bratty, but he liked to have them underfoot, and then he'd take them swimming. You know, they have their time with him in their pajamas. He would play with them first, even if it was a state dinner or just a man's lunch. He just loved to have them around. He really taught Caroline how to swim. He made her dive off the high diving board." She added that when the family was in Hyannisport or Newport or Palm Beach, he'd get on the floor, then he would really roll around with them. None of that playing with the children could ever happen again when he was tragically killed as collateral damage in November 1963. The world had lost a U.S. president, but the children had lost their father, and he had lost them forever. And then there was the human side of Marilyn, the first among them to die, but arguably the most tragic of the three. Before her untimely death, the little girl Norma Jean Mortensen, who became the heartthrob Marilyn Monroe, had, except for the Robert Kennedy mess, seemingly turned her life around, with movie offers galore and a better sense of mental health and the fame and fortune awaiting her. Little doubt exists that she could have become even more of a celebrity, the most beautiful woman on the face of the earth who would continue to warm the hearts of those who watched her on the big screen. Instead, that famous smile and a voice that seemed to purr like a cat's meow, all of the glow that endeared her to millions of fans, was no more, wasted in a death that should have never happened. The result? The only continuing recollections of Marilyn that keep her memory alive today are her movies and her being a multi-million-dollar merchandising vehicle whose image and or apparent endorsement appears on everything from pizza art boards to funky T-shirts to the Marilyn Monroe iPhone soft case to a Macy's clothing line to beach towels at Bed Bath & Beyond. Without question, Marilyn wouldn't approve of many of the ads or television spots, since she has no say as to what products bear her likeness or endorsement. At least some memorable quotes by Marilyn are spotlighted in a few of the ads, such as the ones for the jeweler who represents the Marilyn Monroe collection, where, beside images of the Marilyn Monroe engagement rings and the Marilyn Monroe diamond ring options, there is a photo of Marilyn and her being quoted as having said, "Love bravely," with her signature added for good measure. This said, due to her tragic death, no remarriage for Marilyn to Joe DiMaggio was possible, nor was any future enjoyment of the home that she had always dreamed of owning. Perhaps worse, Marilyn would never be the mother she wanted to be, one who would have certainly given birth to a beautiful child, who she would have loved and loved some more. She couldn't even play with her dog Maff or ever again enjoy the drives she took along the Malibu coast. Ironically, a sensitive look into Marilyn's life and times, one ignored for 67 years and counting, is possible through Dorothy Kilgallen's co-panelist Bennett Cerf, also the publisher, as noted, of Random House. In the July 1953 edition of Esquire magazine, which this author secured, Cerf, in an 8-page article entitled "The Altogether Girl," begins by writing, "Difficult as it may be to believe, there's more to Marilyn Monroe than meets the eye." He then adds, "Behind those purposely seductive curves and genuflections, those moist, slightly parted, provocative lips, lurks a generous nature, an IQ of adequate, if not formidable, proportions, and a fierce desire to become a first-rate actress and cultured, well-informed woman of the world. What I'm trying to say, if I can only get that dazzling facade out of my mind, is that Marilyn is a thoroughly nice kid." The article was based on Cerf visiting the set of Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, where he chatted with not only Marilyn, but co-star Jane Russell, describing the scene in which Marilyn and Jane were attired in black silk tights, clusters of rosettes, high hats, and not much else. Cerf then provides accounts of how Marilyn frustrated directors with her tardiness and demands to reshoot scenes time and time again, her humble and unglamorous past, and meeting Joe DiMaggio for the first time. "I was so scared I didn't dare ask what kind of a ball player Joe was, baseball or football." Impressing Cerf was the placement of two books on a table near where the interview took place, including the Essays of Montaigne, French Renaissance philosopher. To indicate both the child in Marilyn and her sex appeal, Cerf wrote on visiting Marilyn when she was bedridden with the sniffles from posing for still photos scantily dressed. He wrote, "My arm twisted, I decided to make my biography of her my life's work if necessary, and was seated on the edge of her bed in about 7 seconds flat." Providing a strong visual of what he was experiencing, Cerf added, "Even in her simple, unadorned, baby blue kimono, and with only about 2 hours' worth of makeup on her sweet little puss, she exuded, without effort, that certain something which the artist of the most lurid paperback book jacket strives for in vain. Then she grinned at me like a kid." Regarding bearing children, evidence of this being one of Marilyn's fondest wishes comes from, of all places, a little-known March 9, 1999, Philadelphia Daily News late sports edition story. Staff writer Francesca Chapman first detailed Joe DiMaggio's distaste for the limelight, for ending up in a gossip column. To that end, apparently Kilgallen had offered Jolton Joe some free advice that instead of winning and dining starlets at Manhattan's most glamorous night spots, he take a homely girl to Schraft's, a lesser-known eatery on 42nd Street, where the coffee and Danish held in Audrey Hepburn's famous Breakfast at Tiffany's photo was taken. Chapman did not mention whether Joe took Kilgallen's advice, but she went on to chronicle the budding romance between the movie actress and the baseball great all the way to their wedding on January 14, 1954, where 500 breathless fans and reporters packed the halls at San Francisco's City Hall. A cheer went up after the two exchanged vows and during the short Q&A on the outside steps. Chapman wrote, asked if the couple planned to have children, Monroe, who had already owned the crowd by stating that when she went to bed with Joe DiMaggio, the only thing she wore was Chanel No. 5, promptly answered, I'd like to have 6, to which Joe, who, after her death in a tribute to Marilyn's memory, for the next 20 years arranged for bouquets of roses to be sent to her tomb at the Westwood, California mortuary 3 times a week, added, sure, there's going to be a family. Without question, it seems certain that Marilyn would have been a wonderful mother, since she knew from experience what growing up without one by her side was all about. In fact, former husband Arthur Miller once said, to understand Marilyn best, you have to see her around children. The hurt Marilyn felt from lack of a mother being by her side lasted for all of her adult life. But a primary source discovered by this author in August 2020 provides a first-hand account of how Marilyn, despite that hurt, had grown through the years to truly love children. The source is Bob Levitt, mentioned before as the son of Broadway legend Ethel Merman. She knew Marilyn for several years and co-starred with her, as noted, in the motion picture hit There's No Business Like Show Business. Young Levitt, approaching 10 years old at the time the film was being produced, trailed along after his mother to the movie set where Marilyn joined Merman, actor Dan Daly, and singer Johnny Ray in the all-star cast. Right away, for whatever reason, the cute kid and Marilyn bonded since, as Levitt recalled, Marilyn was just so friendly, sweetly friendly. I would call it, towards me as a child, real mother-like. And she reached into my heart with humor and tenderness. He added, during the filming, we may have only spent something like 100 minutes together, yet Marilyn had more of an impression on me than any adult I ever met among all of the show business icons my mother introduced me to. Regarding Marilyn's voice, Levitt called it soft, welcoming, and I moved closer to her so I could listen to what she said. And she smelled good, looked good. Everything was good from a child's perspective, since she was a kid-loving person with a good heart. One special anecdote Levitt recalled had to do with a Prince Valiant sword he had been given at the same time the adventure film of the same name was being produced on a nearby lot. Prince Valiant, Robert Wagner, vows to become a member of King Arthur's Knights of the Round Table in order to return his father to the throne in Scandia. My sword had a big red ruby on the handle, just like the one in the movie, Levitt recalled with authenticity, and Miss Monroe, that's what I always called her, and I talked about it, and I felt like I was the protector fighting for a beautiful woman, Marilyn, a beauty queen, just like Prince Valiant does for a princess, Janet Leigh, in the movie. Levitt said Marilyn handled my sword. She liked it. She entered my fantasy world. She had such a natural love of a child like me. He added, later I used to think about her since I had a recording of Heat Wave that she sang in the musical, and I'd stand in front of my sister's large mirror for hours and hours and pretend to dance with Marilyn just like what happened in the film. Summarizing, Levitt said, Marilyn was one of the nice people I knew when I was a child. And I didn't like it when my mother and some of her friends said bad things about Marilyn in the dressing room. They were just jealous and vindictive. She had a divine femininity to her, and I'll always remember her as someone who lifted me out of the prison I felt at the time by being part of a dysfunctional family. Sadly, there would be no children born to Marilyn, none that she could enjoy like the relationship she had with young Levitt, none she could laugh with and play with and be the childlike person she really was, the one that few, if any, of those millions of fans even knew existed. She was robbed of this pleasure when she died, arguably the worst part of her death at age 36. In addition, Marilyn acting on Broadway, as she dreamed of doing, never would happen. And her completing Something's Got to Give, a huge step in her acting career, was shut down when she died. Who knows what Marilyn's movie future would have included? hopefully more roles to showcase her as much more than a pretty face, a serious actress to be reckoned with regardless of the parts that she played on the big screen. This is the Marilyn that died, the Marilyn who would never again be able to speak with her half-sister Bernice or her niece Mona, the Marilyn who could never again interact with those in her profession that she loved, the Strasbergs, Dean Martin, and many more, the Marilyn who could never mother Joe DiMaggio during his times of turmoil, and the Marilyn whose fun-loving spirit on the big screen entertained millions who loved her like a daughter or sister. This was Marilyn the human being, the sometimes shy, insecure Marilyn, arguably the most beautiful woman inside and out, the real Marilyn Monroe. One opinion of Marilyn worthy of close-up consideration is certainly that of Jim Doherty, her first husband. In his book, The Secret Happiness of Marilyn Monroe, he wrote in 1974, "If Norma Jean hadn't gone into the movies, she would be alive today. There would have been someone around, someone close to her, whom she could have leaned on. But when you get into the film industry, there aren't too many people around you can lean on. Evidently, those she knew weren't such good friends that they could help her, or she wouldn't be dead today." Doherty added, "I don't think she ever really intended to become a sex symbol. When she entered films, she wanted to be an actress, someone who could play any part. Character actress, Susan Hayward and Betty Davis come to mind. I don't think their first concern was being sexy. If the studios had allowed her to develop in that direction, I think she could have survived. She could have handled that. But she was surrounded by leeches who had no true regard for her, only for the money she was making and the extraordinary publicity she was attracting. However, the leeches and Bobby Kennedy, it seems apparent, won, and Marilyn was erased from the face of the earth, preventing her from continuing to be one of the brightest stars in the world. That smile, that soft voice, that loving way she reached into movie audiences and wrapped them around her finger. What a joy she could have been, her love affair with a public that adored her, growing as an actress and as a human being as the years passed. But it wasn't to be. Marilyn Monroe, President John F. Kennedy, and Dorothy Kilgallen, each dead within 40 months of each other. Three unique and never-to-be-forgotten souls, each a victim denied justice whose life and times and deaths will bind them forever. Marilyn at age 36, JFK at age 46, and Dorothy Kilgallen at age 52.